Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me is my friend, it is the fabulous Monty Merrick, who is the friend of our local wildlife. Welcome, Monty.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm the director of the Wildlife Care Center, I guess, just to clear that up.
Director.
And I'm a co-director of Bird Ally X.
Wonderful. Today we're talking about how humans impact wildlife and your work on the front lines of trying to take care of that wildlife that has been harmed and the good work of the Wildlife Care Center. So let's just start off on who you are, Monty, and how you got into this kind of interesting work of wildlife rehabilitation. How did you end up here in Humboldt County taking care of injured foxes and sandpipers and all sorts of different wildlife?
Well, I didn't have a background in zoology or anything like that. Like most of the people in this field, I came out of more of an English history studies background. It's kind of an unusual feature, but you know, it's a field that's really driven by compassion, first and foremost. So I think that's a large part of it. And it's also really, really underpaid. And it's mostly done by volunteers around the world. And volunteers with means, free time, and compassion tend to be, well, people not in my demographic, that's for sure. The field of wildlife rehabilitation is absolutely driven by, led by, and is mostly populated by women whose children are old enough to go to college. And they have some means, so they don't necessarily need the job for the income. And that's who does the work, generally speaking, around the country, for sure. Here in Humboldt County, it's a little different. And, you know, I got here in, well, I moved to Humboldt County at the end of 2009, leaving a wildlife job in the Bay Area, sort of ended up here at Humboldt Wildlife Care Center, because there was a sudden pelican incident where, you know, at the local fish cleaning docks from Crescent City down to Shelter Cove, pelicans were getting into the freshly cleaned catch. There were just open bins, or in Shelter Cove, there used to be a grinder that ground up the day's remains from everybody cleaning their catch at the fish cleaning station. And then it would just get ground up and spewed back into the ocean. And the pipe hung above the water in Shelter Cove, and pelicans, juvenile pelicans, would sit under that pipe and get drenched in essentially pink slime. You know, it was ground up fish parts. So anyway, that ended up being like maybe not the coolest thing, especially since an area of biological significance. Is that actually a term?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not a term, it sounds as if it
sounds good, right? Well, I think it's designated something like that, Shelter Cove is. And you know, and the thing about the coast of California is that places like Shelter Cove and Bodega Bay and Humboldt Bay and Bolinas Lagoon and Francisco Bay and all of these beautiful inlet spots are essentially diving school for brown pelicans. Going from being a brown pelican chick to somebody who can go from 75 feet above the ocean into the cold North Pacific and come out of it with dinner does take some learning, you know, and they use these coves as basically a nursery school to get the hang of it. And unfortunately, over the last 150 years, people have pretty much industrialized all of those places. And so you have juvenile pelicans who for millions of years, literally millions of years, when I did a thing on this back when it was happening in 2011, I had a presentation on it that I did around town and also took to conferences and stuff. And pelican bills have largely, they remain unchanged. We have like fossil records of pelicans 30 million years ago. So like they're very evolved to what their specialty is. And they've been doing it a very long time and it works. And they swallow fish whole. So we were pulling tuna heads that were lodged in pelican throats because they were getting them out of dumpsters. And it was juvies, you know, they didn't know any better. We did not pick up one single adult. 2 years in a row this happened. We ended up with like between the 2 years together, 300 pelicans had been impacted. Not a single adult was, the adults that we picked up were guys that happened to be there and were injured for some other reason. So just to put it in context. So anyway, that's what, that incident is what got me involved with the Wildlife Care Center, because one of the aspects of Bird Ally X that we've always built into our mission statement is providing rehab centers that maybe don't have the opportunity to develop techniques for dealing with a large influx of patients in a catastrophic sense, because I'd come out of an oil spill background. So that was kind of my specialty, you know, like one minute you have no surf scoters in care and now you have 200 surf scoters in care because of an oil spill. So anyway, we were developing that and it happened here. And as it turns out, the stuff we had to build at Humboldt Wildlife Care Center in 2011 was really extensive and required skill to operate it. So I just ended up hanging around and that sort of stuck. I don't mean to say I'm stuck.
But you've been hanging around now for 11 years and there are some big changes afoot at the Wildlife Care Center. So I understand that you are moving and this place that you've called home, the Wildlife Care Center has called home for over a decade, is moving. So can you talk a little bit about that challenge? Because as I understand it, there's pretty substantial kind of infrastructure built up, all the different specialized cages or areas for your patients to use, all needs to go from one home to a new one.
Yeah, it's a saying that goes something like, how do you rebuild a ship at sea? One board at a time. And that's kind of, I guess that is what we're facing. And, you know, I don't want to make light of it because it's been a huge stress because, you know, our lease here ends at the end of this year, which is the amount of time we have to be moved. We have to meet our mission of taking care of animals at the same time as dismantling the hospital and building another one. So we have found a piece of property that we are in the middle of trying to get. It's for sale. So when I say trying to get, what I actually mean is funding. It's not like we're trying to convince the person to give it to us. We're not. We're trying to raise the money to buy it. And what's great about this place is that going into it, it's already got a building and it's already got power and it's already got water. And it doesn't have anything else, but the rest of that is we don't have to have everything at once. We can build as we go a little bit, which is much what I did here. You know, in 2011, the infrastructure, the facility that we had here wasn't very developed either. We had one outdoor aviary and it wasn't even that well built because if we used it, animals were constantly getting themselves hurt in it because it wasn't properly constructed for wildlife. So yeah, it's daunting for sure. There were some setbacks. You know, I had a little health problem that kind of put me down for a minute right after we discovered we were going to be moving. So yeah, some setbacks. You know, one of the nice things about doing work that's utterly necessary is that failure is really, as they say, not an option. At how it turns out and how pretty it is, that's maybe a different story, but we're going to get it done. Obviously, we're going to get it done with the broad support of the community.
And I appreciate that. Working in a nonprofit, I understand, although my nonprofit is vastly different than yours. There are life and death stakes at yours. So a large, large amount of respect for you and your staff for all that you do. So also, I understand that in moving, there's going to be expenses. You know, you're still working on trying to purchase this property. There's going to be expensive in setting up your new facility. If folks are interested in helping to contribute, you can find a link in the show notes if you're listening to this as a podcast, or you can go to the lostcoastoutpost.com and look for this episode, and there'll be a link to the Humboldt Wildlife Care Center's donation page. And I'm sure Monty and all of his staff and volunteers would sincerely appreciate it, and his patients too.
And indeed.
So let's talk about the idea of patients, because it is perhaps interesting language for somebody who hasn't been involved in wildlife rehabilitation to conceive of wildlife as a patient, which is a term that perhaps most people would ordinarily assume for a human receiving care. Talk a little bit about the philosophy behind wildlife care and viewing wildlife as distinct individuals worthy of receiving care.
Sure. Well, you know, that's gets to the very heart of the matter is, here's the thing, you know, if you're walking down the street and let's say it's a nice town that has trees and planting strips and sidewalks and curbs and cars parked, and there in the planting strip between the sidewalk and the curb, you see a robin who's obviously most likely, you don't know necessarily what happened, but let's just say a robin who's been hit by a car and has a broken wing and isn't moving around very much. And you see them there, there's a strong possibility you're going to want to do something, right? You're not, oh, tough luck guy, and keep on walking. Sure, there's a lot of people that may feel that way and do that, but there's a significant number of people, a lot, I don't know how many, I don't know what percentage of people that are compassionate is, but there's people that are going to want to do something. And our facility and wildlife rehabilitation isn't that old as a permitted activity. It dates back to the late 70s. And then the first 20 years was like professionalizing wildlife rehab and things like that. I mean, obviously there's people that have cared for wild animals as long as there's been people.
Since time immemorial, right? There's something instinctual about it. When you see another sentient being in pain, you want to relieve that pain and have them go back to their merry existence.
I mean, in the beginning, the facility that I started at up in Seattle, Progressive Animal Welfare Society, had an adjunct wildlife hospital called Wildlife Center, the Paws Wildlife Center, and which is where I started in 1999. And they had been established at that point for less than 20 years as a wildlife hospital. But then the first thing that happened was people were bringing them wild animals, and the best that they could do was euthanize. That's actually fantastic. I mean, it's terrible to think of all of the death, but just to end the suffering is a huge part of what we do. And it's not like three cheers for euthanasia, but it's a major tool. It is a way of providing care. And that's one of the, as an aside, in wildlife rehab, it's fantastic because there are no animals euthanized because they're unwanted. It's not like there's just too many puppies or too many kittens. I have a lot of friends that work in domestic animal care, and I know that the euthanasia of perfectly healthy kittens and puppies is one of the aching parts of that work because there's more of them than there are homes for them. So we don't really have that. In our situation, euthanasia is a form of care. This is an animal, an opossum hit by a car, who has multiple skull fractures and is in a situation that you just don't even want to even look at her. And fate has left her alive. And we take care of that.
That is the compassionate thing to do. There is a point to which there's not recovery, where it is the good thing, despite it being, I imagine, a very emotionally challenging thing to have to do.
Well, I think this field is, while it's not that common of a field, I mean, if you go to a national conference of wildlife rehabilitators at a good year, when it's very well attended, there might be 300 people there. But almost every community has a wildlife facility with people who do this work. We have a pretty big area here, but I guess I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of people that do this, and I would hate to single myself out as like, oh, and this is this horrible, you know, I go into the trenches and see all, there's a lot of people that do that. And I can tell you that, like, I think if you talk to any first responder, one of the things that you'll hear from them is, yeah, the work is hard, but it beats doing nothing. And that's totally, if you're watching an oil spill on television, it can tear your heart apart. But if you're actually out there helping the animals who've been impacted, it really gives you something to do. And then you also get to be the guy that Fred Rogers told the kids to look for when they're dealing with catastrophes. He's like, look for the helpers. There's always helpers. And then you get to be one of those helpers. And it's not like there's a lot of reward in this job, except for like the reward of jobs well done. But being one of the helpers, it's a nice thing to reflect on about yourself at the end of the day.
Oh, absolutely. I would like to think that what what we do in the other side, in the conservation advocacy side, that we're also part of the helpers. It is a different world, but it allows me to go to sleep a little bit easier than I think if I was just some corporate attorney or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about what patients you have currently at the Wildlife Care Center. I admit, I saw you the other day at the co-op buying what just looked like an absolute ton of eggs. And when I saw you stacking them inside of your basket, I was wondering if you were going into bodybuilding or something and needed all the protein. Or then I remembered, oh, he probably has a lot of hungry friends that are looking forward to those eggs. So who are you feeding these days? Who's in the care
center? There's a lot of patients eat the eggs, hence buying them by the 4 or 5 dozen a day. But the raccoon kits, small baby, you know, baby and juvenile opossums, skunks. We just released the last of our skunks that we had in care at the end of last week. We have gray fox kits in care, and those are the primary egg eaters. When we have corvids, crows, ravens, Steller's jays, those guys get eggs too. But yeah, it's baby season. So everybody that we have is a baby. We just yesterday released 7 barn swallows and 3 cliff swallows. We'd had them for about a month. They came in as naked nestlings, and now they're out there doing their thing. About, 15 more swallows still in care. We have house finches in care. They're fun. They just are. They just got to the point where they don't care about us anymore.
Wonderful. Welcome to the Eco News. Today we're talking about how humans impact wildlife and work on the front lines of trying to take care of that wildlife that has been harmed and the good work of the Wildlife Care Center.
We spend a lot of time making a lot of effort to not habituate animals to us because respecting their freedom and keeping their freedom intact, their wildness intact. Yeah, so we want to keep their wildness intact, but feeding baby songbirds does require them to open their mouth so you can put food in it, right? So we do have to convince them that we are the source of food. So there's a bit of habituating them to us because we're not their parent. And with songbirds, fortunately, a lot of their behavior is innate. And once they're ready to start self-feeding, it's like a switch turns off. Now, we of course do things to make sure that they only see us at feeding time. Like we don't have them on display. We always have a barrier between them and us except for at feeding time. So they don't even know what we look like, really. Just a hand coming in with the hemostats and a worm hanging off of it.
That not habituating the animals also is a form of long-term care. Interactions with humans are part of the reason why they're there in the first place. We want to ensure their wildness, and ensuring their wildness will ensure that, hopefully, that they will live nice, long lives as they were meant to.
Yes. I don't know, you've probably heard about this, but some people aren't very nice. So yeah, definitely a healthy fear of human beings is required. I just had 2 days off. And when I came in this morning, the first thing I did was go out to feed the house finches. And it's kind of an ego boost when they love you, because they all come. I have a syringe full of the formula that I'm feeding, right, to the house finches. Like they're opening their mouths. I squirt it in. So I'm holding a syringe and like 3 house finches are sitting on the syringe. They're like, we want, you know, so like that's very exciting. And if you're having a bad day, go feed the house finches. It's a heck of an ego boost. But no more. Today, they were like, why are you in here? I'm not even in here. And I stepped back out, you know.
Are house finches, are they your favorite patient? Usual?
No, they're just fun. You know, I don't have a favorite patient. I mean, I love pelicans, but I also love Swainson's thrushes. And they're all interesting. I mean, raccoons are the bomb.
They're so smart. They're so remarkably smart.
Yeah. Raccoons are like, next time you come out here, bring a chessboard. And I'm like, no. I'm not going to lose to a raccoon.
Do you have a most memorable patient?
Well, I do have a most memorable patient. I wish it was somebody I hadn't already mentioned, but it was a pelican. And it was a guy I released at Point Arena about 12 years ago. But he was a patient who we had treated 3 times. His recidivism rate was extremely high. He's a juvie. He was found in a parking lot at a grocery store, Ray's, going in the outdoor. So yes, I can tell he's a juvenile. He doesn't even know. He can't even read.
Going in the outdoor, you know he's a juvenile for doing something stupid like that, right?
Yeah, totally. So we got him, and then we released him, and then he came back in with fishing line tangled around him from a fishing pier. And so we treated the wounds that he got from that and got him together, and then we released him. And about 2 weeks later, he came back. And there was a lot of talk that maybe this guy's just not cut out for the wild. Maybe we should rethink whether it's like, should we continue to provide care? There was a staff meeting where we genuinely tossed around the idea of euthanasia. Like he's just not doing it. But at this point, he was a little older. He was in great body condition. The physical parameters of his health were intense. And I lobbied for, let's choose a release site that isn't San Francisco Bay. And I took him and to get him into a group of pelicans where there's adults, because predators like pelicans, like wolves, require adult supervision. Before they're on their own, they need to learn how it works. They need to see it in action. They need to try it themselves. One of the interesting things about juveniles versus adults, and pelicans illustrate this really nicely, is that a pelican who's an adult will dive for a fish, right? From 75 feet up, as I mentioned. And on the way down, if the pelican decides it's not going to happen, an adult will abort the dive because it takes a lot of energy to get back up into the air. Adults are straight down divers. Juveniles come in at any angle from all directions. And once they commit, they're all in. And I feel a real kinship with that because I remember my own juvenile years. And I feel like I was sort of the same way. I was chaotic, pell-mell, but I was committed and went the full distance every single time, whether it was jumping my bicycle off of a pier or jumping out of trees as stuntman practice. I was 100% going for it. And I feel like juvenile pelicans demonstrate that as well. And I admire them a lot for it. So this pelican that was fantastic. And I was like, oh, I'll find him a group. And I headed for Jenner, which is, you know, where the mouth of the Russian River is into the ocean. And there's always pelicans there, Goat Rock, pelicans hanging around. Goat Rock is painted white with bird poop. And we get there, and the only day of the year when there's no pelicans. So we hop in the car and we go north, and every little cove we stop at, no pelicans. It's like the pelicanless day of the summer. I've never seen anything like it. And finally, we see a group of pelicans, but we just missed them. They were flying north, and it was like four adults and about 10 juveniles and then three more adults. And I was like, this is the perfect group for this guy. They've got complete and total escorts. It's like Boy Scouts going camping. We got to get our guy into this group. So we're flying. We can drive faster than them. So I drive and we drive. And we get up there and we get to this cove and I pull in. And by gosh, here comes that group of pelicans still coming up to the coast. And I see that we're not going to get ready in time, that they're going to bass us before we have our guy out of the car and out of his crate and into the air. And so we decided to just, instead of trying to hit, we just drove all the way to Point Arena, which was another like 45 minutes. And we get to, maybe not that far, about 30 minutes from where we were. So we get to Point Arena, we get our guy out, we're right on the bluff. It's like, if this doesn't work, we're gonna lose this guy for sure, because there will be no recovery if he jumps into flight from here. But I believe, and so we're just south of, if you've been to Point Arena, there's the lighthouse, and we're just south of that on the road that goes to the lighthouse. And we're set up and ready, and just like clockwork, here comes that group of pellies, and they're flying up, and we get our guy ready. And just as they're getting to us, we open the crate of our pelican, and he steps out, steps off the bluff, spreads his wings, swoops down, and arrives into that group just as they're passing us. And he slipped in and flew with them and went around the lighthouse and out of sight. And we never heard from him again. Like, obviously he was banded. So if he had come into care and anybody had gotten him again, we would have known that. But it is definitely, once you release guys into their wild freedom, they don't send cards letting you know how they are making out. So there is a bit of a anticlimactic.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, now, and then they lived happily ever after, we hope.
I imagine you are still thinking about him all these years later, wondering how he's doing.
Yeah. And, you know, pelicans have a nice long life. He could be alive. I mean, pelicans live 40 years.
Well, I hope that someday you cross paths with him in the wild and not at the care center and him in flight. That'd be lovely. So we are at the height of summer. Birds are a little bit older. Juvenile birds are a little bit older. So the kind of needs of the care center are a little bit different. Who's coming into the care center these days? What are you seeing? What are the kind of problems?
Well, a smattering of fledglings coming in still in the way of birds. But mostly, yeah, those guys are, that has slowed down considerably. And now we're starting to see juveniles who are, it's their first year on their own. And they may or may not be making it. So I just, in fact, right before we started having this conversation, I had just gotten back. I had gone down to Elk River Road to pick up a fox that somebody had found in their backyard this morning, who was exhibiting signs that people can be frightened by, because it's a wild animal in their yard acting strangely. So it was a fox, and he was just laying there, and then he'd get up and he would stumble and tip over. And when I got him, he did look a little worse for wear and tear, but probably he's just starving. Probably he's separated from his family. It may be the right normal thing for him at this point, but just because it's right and normal doesn't mean he's good at it. So struggling juveniles are really common. We start getting skunks that are mid-size. An adult skunk is about 1,800 grams, And we start getting like these 700-800 gram guys that are older than, like, they would have already been released if they'd been in our care, but they're older than what we would ordinarily have in care, but they're also not fully grown yet. And they're just not getting it together. Usually at most a few weeks of food. And while we have them, we do a little bit of training on here's how you find food, just in case you need a refresher course. So we hide stuff for them and we give them live prey tests, which means putting a mouse that is alive in their house with them. It's not a job I like doing particularly, but we have to. It'd be irresponsible to release a predator that didn't demonstrate he knew what to do with a live animal that is of the type he eats.
That all makes sense. I want to make sure that everybody in our listening audience knows what to do if they find some animal that's in need of some TLC, some tender loving care.
Yeah.
So Monty, what should folks do if they come across an animal that is hurt or just kind of otherwise generally not doing well? Who should they call?
Well, they should definitely give us a call, 707-822-8839. And we are here and we answer the phone every day between 9 and 5. And we get back to everybody who calls in other hours. We're here every day. You know, one of the disadvantages of moving is that people know where we are and people roll up here all day long with animals that they found without calling us, without check. And that's not a criticism. I'm super grateful for it. And we'll have to build up our new location pretty strongly. And if you don't know, just call us, 707-822-8839. And we can absolutely help you decide what you should do. And if it's something that you don't feel you can do comfortably, like, you know, if you find a bat is one of the rabies vector species. And if you touch that bat and that bat scratches you, that bat will have to go in for testing because rabies is no joke. If you've been exposed to rabies, you need to know it. There's treatment that will prevent you from dying and you need to get that treatment. So if you get bitten or scratched by a bat, we are going to euthanize that bat. We don't want to necessarily, but we're going to because the bat has to go in for testing. We send the bat to the Department of Public Health and they do a testing. And you can only test for rabies in bats. Apparently, the only way that it can be done is by looking at their brain under a microscope, and the death comes before that.
I guess the story there is if you find a bat, call an expert from the Wildlife Care Center. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to come out there and help. Or if there's other species like a fox, I think of myself as a somewhat brave person, but if I had to try to deal with an injured fox, I don't think I'm that brave. So I would give the Wildlife Care Center a call and perhaps I would see you come out to my property to care for that animal.
We absolutely do that. It's funny because it's not that common in our field. Most rehab facilities are like, we will take care of any animal you bring us. And very few actually have the resources or devote the resources to going out on rescues. Well, first of all, I'd never really cared for that at all the places that I worked. And when I got here and nobody was telling me I couldn't, we just started doing it. But somebody in Eureka who doesn't have an automobile, getting to Bayside that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. It's 4 or 5 miles. And so we'd run out and get them. And we will do that. We'll definitely go get animals. Like I just went and got that fox. And I think that not being comfortable with picking up a wild animal, there's no shame in that. There's very little in our lives that prepares us for it. The chances that in your life you're going to see an injured wild animal is maybe slim. I mean, it's happened to me a lot, but I kind of put myself there. I go down to the bus station where sick wild animals come, so I tend to see them a lot, but maybe other people don't. So it's not like something that you have a priori experience with. Like you're like, ah, yes, we covered this on the swim team.
Right. There's no required course to graduate from high school. Wildlife Care 101. Well, Monty, I'd like to really thank you and all the volunteers and staff of the Wildlife Care Center. If folks want to find out more information about the Wildlife Care Center, where should they go?
Our website, www, like all of them, birdallyx.net, birdallyx.net. Money is not the only way that you can help or contributions of other kinds. Your labor is also welcome. And so if people want to volunteer, there's links there that they can do that too. And we are always looking for volunteers. Our demographic here, it tends to be very college adult, sorry, kids. People in college tend to be because of the unusualness of HSU or Cal Poly being right there. So they need the adult supervision. So if you're like a grown-up already, come on down and volunteer and help guide these kids into knowing how to mop floors better.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Monty. This has been another episode of the Eco News Report. If you're interested in finding out more about wildlife rehabilitation here locally in Humboldt County, go to birdallyx.net. And thank you so much to the Humboldt Wildlife Care Center. Join us again on this time and channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.